Word of mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott.
We're defying the studio rules by having food in the studio. So don't. So make sure no one sees.
A few days ago, we broke NHPR's no food in the studio policy for a legitimate reason. Our producer, Molly Donahue, baked a delicious homemade apple pie from a recipe that gained popularity during the American Civil War.
Okay, so we're having an apple pie. What's the Civil War part?
Well, it is a cracker and sugar pie, actually.
What?
There are no apples. It's all Ritz cracker and sugar, some cinnamon, water, and that's pretty much it.
Incredibly, the mock apple pie not only tasted like the real deal, it looked like it, too.
You're kidding me. Like, this stuff that, as you look at the side, that looks like apples,
yeah.
That's what...
Those are Ritz crackers that have been boiled.
So why would anybody make an apple pie without any apples?
The only real fruit in it is lemon juice.
And what's that from, like, squeeze a lemon?
Yeah.
Like many recipes, finding an original author is, you know, very rare, almost impossible. What I do know is that mock apple pie didn't start in the Civil War era. What I think happened is that the disruptions of the war made it more popular and made apples harder to come by.
That is Helen Zoe Veit, editor of a collection called Food in the Civil War Era, The South. She joined us to talk about how the Civil War shaped our notions of regional American food and what a critical role food played in the conflict. Well, those disruptions are such a big part of what your book is revealing to us. In a time of deprivation and even famine during the Civil War, what were people eating in the South during the war?
Well, one thing that happened for almost all people in all social classes, whether they were free or enslaved, is that food changed a lot. Wealthier Southerners were certainly more insulated from those privations. In many cases, especially early on, life went on more or less as normal. Imports tapered off. They weren't necessarily getting the citrus fruits they had had or the sugar. But things definitely changed by the middle of the war. And for poorer Southerners, the deprivations were sometimes very hard indeed. And sometimes, as you mentioned, even real famine, especially in the most isolated mountain areas, for example, in northern Georgia, where there really was no transportation structure to get people food in the winter months.
Mm-hmm. So what were people eating?
So, for example, if early on, one thing that surprised me about looking at food in the Civil War era South was how much food had been imported before the war, and imported from Europe, in many cases imported from the Caribbean, but also imported from other places in the United States, from especially the Midwest, where Southerners got a lot of their wheat and their pork and their beef, certainly. And so once the war started, those sorts of food imports, were cut off. And so things like meat, even pork, which I had sort of assumed was a local Southern food, you
mm-hmm.
know, Southerners were growing their own pigs.
Right.
Actually, that wasn't the case in many cases. So what had been a food economy that had really had a lot of inputs suddenly had to be local for the first time. And so Southerners were eating a lot less meat than they had been. Another thing that really changed for all Southerners was that one of their main ways of preserving foods, which had been salting them, suddenly couldn't exist anymore because Southerners had imported almost all of their salt. They'd mainly imported it from Wales, in fact. So once the northern blockade around southern shores cut off imports from Europe, Southerners had to scramble to find a way to preserve their food. And, of course, in the southern climate, especially in the warmer months, preservation was absolutely crucial because if you had a side of pork, but you had no way to salt it or no way to preserve it otherwise, that food would rot.
Hmm.
And then you'd be wasting valuable food.
So there were a lot of improvisations we see in the book. What are some that you discovered?
Well, to get around the salt shortage, for example, some people tried to find salt in other ways. The first thing they thought of course, was that, well, there's a blockade around our southern shores, but we still have the shores themselves. We have salt water. So people tried boiling down vats of salt water, which seems smart. The problem was to do that in any sort of a scale, took massive amounts of firewood to boil that water, and that just wasn't sustainable for most people. People did things like boiling old salt sacks to try to eke out a little bit of salt, or some people sifted through the floors of their sheds where they had salted to try to get up the salt crystals that had fallen for decades. Some people tried doing things like curing meats in molasses, you know, hoping that that would act as a preservative. What they mainly ended up doing was going without, ultimately.
Yeah. There are some recipes here, though. They make oysters, quote-unquote oysters, out of green corn, for example.
Yes.
So much imagination. But I'm thinking of, you know, the Southern diet as collard greens, okra, fried chicken, so many foods that we think of as Southern. Were they part of that tradition before the war?
Yes. That is one thing I talk a lot about in this book, because I think when you say Southern food, people today have instant ideas that come to mind. We think of okra or yams or cornbread or pork. And a lot of those foods are in these cookbooks, the ones from the war itself. And I also look at a few cookbooks that were published earlier. What was also there were a lot of other things. You see roast beef. You see Yorkshire pudding. You see gazpacho. You see all sorts of surprising things that we don't think of as Southern. And another thing that I discovered when doing this book was that I was also looking at Northern cookbooks. And what surprised me was how many foods that I thought of as exclusively Southern were also showing up in those Northern cookbooks, mm-hmm. whether it was, you know, cornbread or gumbo or watermelon pickles, you know, all sorts of things I was surprised to find in the North as well. And I realized a couple of things about Southern cuisine as we think about it today. One thing is that we really canonized the flavors from the Civil War era. When we think about Southern cuisine, we're really thinking about food from the 1850s and 1860s, in part because of the war. In other words, the war made Southern food special for the first time.
How do you mean?
For example, one crucial part of cooking in the mid-19th century was preservation. People had to preserve foods all the time because there wasn't mechanical refrigeration. They had to make food last. So, for example, when I think of Southern food, I actually grew up in North Carolina. You know, I think of sausages or homemade liquors or jams or fruit syrups or salting foods or smoking them. And those are all preservation techniques that people no longer needed in the 20th century. But in part because of their association with the Civil War era, people kept doing it. It became considered a part of Southern heritage in a way that we don't think of those as Northern foods, although Northerners in that same era were doing the same thing.
Hmm.
Another example is those collard beans or green beans. You know, people in the South still cook food to death. You know, they cook vegetables to death. They cook greens with salt pork or bacon, and they're delicious. But that was something that people were doing in the 19th century all over the country, in part because they believed you had to do that to make food, to make vegetables digestible. People in the 19th century believed that if you just ate collard greens that had been lightly boiled for 5 minutes, that it would actually literally be indigestible and would hurt you. Your body couldn't take it in. You would get sick. And so, you know, I think that this 19th century cooking technique, because it was associated with the Civil War era, became canonized, became part of people's memory of what the South was, and was one reason that people kept doing it. I think another is that it tastes good.
What were Southerners eating during the lean years of the Civil War? Well, my guest, Helen Zoe Veit, is editor of a new collection of recipes and history called Food in the Civil War Era, the South. Another big surprise for me was about how much of Southern food came from a history of conflict. And this is from the introductory essay to your collection of Southern Civil War recipes. Christopher Ferris, she's describing Southern cuisine as food introduced almost in opposition to or in conflict, not just during the war, but earlier clashes with Native Americans. Mm-hmm. What are some of the foods that Southern settlers depended on then, long before the war?
Absolutely. So, I mean, when you're looking at Southern cuisine, you're really seeing a combination of European cuisines and foods and African foods and definitely Native American foods. Things like tomatoes and beans and sweet potatoes and corn, of course. You know, these are all foods that were native to the Americas before white settlers arrived. There were a lot of African foods that also became key parts of Southern food, things like black-eyed peas or okra or yams. These are all West African foods that people who had been captured to be enslaved brought with them and brought knowledge about their cultivation as well, also mm-hmm. rice.
There's a whole section of recipes in this book using squirrels, fricassee squirrel pies. I mean, is this meant to actually be used as a cookbook or read as history?
Well, you know, I leave that to the reader. But I do think that there is, you know, growing interest even among people today who don't have to eat squirrels for any reason in sort of thinking more broadly about what kinds of foods are edible, what kinds of foods are acceptable, and also what body parts. There are also a lot of recipes in here for organs or brains or livers, you know, things that probably most people, most Americans today don't normally eat, maybe think of as disgusting. But I think there's also growing interest in broadening what we think of as acceptable.
You've now edited a collection of cookbooks about Civil War foods in the North and in the South. Did food play a role in deciding this war?
Absolutely, yes. Southerners' inability to feed themselves was absolutely crucial in deciding the war. The South's agricultural system was so productive. You know, they had a huge amount of land, they had a great climate, but it was absolutely focused on cotton.
Mm-hmm.
And Southerners didn't move quickly enough away from cotton once the war started, you know, mainly because they thought the war would be a short one. No one really understood the duration. They were overconfident, and they hadn't realized how impermeable the blockade would become. They wouldn't be able to import their food in the same way. And Southerners' inability to feed themselves and to grow the food and to move the food where they needed it was absolutely crucial. And it was one reason that Southern troops, Confederate troops, deserted in droves by the end. They were hungry, and their families were hungry at home, and they were writing them and saying, come back and help me farm. We're starving.
Well, Helen, thank you so much for a fascinating book and conversation. I appreciate your time.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Helen Zoe Veit is editor of Food in the Civil War Era, the South. She's associate professor at Michigan State University and director of the upcoming What America Ate project. You'll find some Civil War recipes to try out in your own kitchen at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. And a big thanks to our producer, Molly Donahue, for baking that delicious, and I do mean delicious, mock apple pie.